This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Lod Cook, the man whose name is on the Lod Cook Alumni Center at LSU and one of the most prominent graduates of the old war school, former chair of Atlantic Richfield and now head of a company that is about to make big news, NeuroSigma. We'll talk with Lod Cook about his amazing life. Also, John Ed Bradley, his first job as a journalist, the former LSU center, all-conference performer. His first job was with the Washington Post. He was hired by a guy named Ben Bradley, who died this week at the age of 93 after an amazing career in journalism. We'll hear from the new head of the Louisiana Community and Technical College System, Dr. Monty Sullivan. But now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, or tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Lod Cook coming in a few minutes, the fabulous titan of business who's been one of the great benefactors of LSU. But we start with another LSU legend, John Ed Bradley, all-conference center for the Tigers in 1979 and now one of the world's best writers. Good morning, John Ed Bradley.
Hey, Jim.
Well, John Ed, good to hear your voice. And John Ed Bradley, as we've noted on this show a few times, began his career in journalism in an unlikely place for a budding journalist, the Washington Post, and his boss was a guy named Ben Bradley, another Bradley, with spelled differently, who hired him in 1982 when John Ed was all of 23 years old. How did it happen?
It was a miraculous thing for me. I graduated with a degree in English and went to law school. And I was really biding my time. I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I just couldn't figure out how to make that happen. So I went to law school, and I was miserable. I started writing to publications around the country. I think I wrote to 50. And everybody, you know, turned me down. I couldn't get a writing job. And I finally wrote to Ben Bradley at the Washington Post. And he replied. The story goes that he fished my my letter out of a big bin filled with other letters, and he liked the letter. He passed it on to one of his assistants, who then passed it on to the sports editor. That guy was a former Florida man. He was a Florida graduate, and he had a dim memory of my having played at LSU. They gave me a freelance job, and that's how I started. 6 months later, I was sitting in Ben's office, and, you know, there he was, Jason Robards. I kept flashing at that movie. But he was incredible. He was an incredible guy and so good to me. Without him, I don't know what might have happened to my life. You know, I don't know where I'd be today. But I remember when I interviewed with him, one question he asked me was, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I told him that I wouldn't be at the Washington Post, that I would be writing books, and that I hoped to learn all I could from him, and then I was going to move on. And I think he liked that answer. I think most people probably reply that they were going to win the Pulitzer, or they were going to, you know, I don't know, be a columnist. But I didn't want to be a newspaper guy. Even then, I knew that I wanted to be in book publishing.
Well, you lived down the street from him. You had
the same
last name with one letter changed. And I think it's fair to say you're a man's man, and so was he. So you had a lot in common.
You know, I liked him. I think everybody in that newsroom liked Ben. He was his door was always open. He was accessible, and he had an aura about him. He was this larger than life character. After having played at LSU, I don't think I was in awe of anybody or anything. You know, you play in Tiger Stadium, you get over that kind of stuff. And so I felt that I, even though I was a young guy, I kind of met him, you know, man to man, and I did like him. We talked a lot. I used to walk. We lived on N Street. He lived in a mansion, and I had a small apartment in a row house. But I would have to walk by his house to get to the paper, and I often saw him out there, and we would talk. And you know, I can remember when I decided to resign my position and leave the paper. I went down there and talked to him for about an hour out in front of his house, and you know, he just. You know, he was just a guy I liked. He was, you know, I went from LSU and the locker room to the Washington Post and the newsroom, and I really responded to the camaraderie, the whole team aspect of the work. And he you know, he was, he could have been something different because he had a place in history then, but he was just a good guy, mm-hmm. You know, a one of a kind, but a very, likeable person, always laughing, had a beautiful smile. You know, I remember the women in the newsroom just loved him. And he would walk around in the morning, and, you know, I can remember the thrill I'd get whenever he came over to talk to me about a story I'd written, you know, and he would make a point of doing it in front of all your colleagues. And when he singled you out that way, it was an amazing thing to experience.
Well, he was born in 1921. Charlie McClendon, another mentor of yours, was born in 1923. And even though they were much different types of men, as far as their personal integrity and their passion for what they did, I think it's fair to say they had a large impact on you.
They did. You know, they were both. Funny thing is, I was with both of them for 4 years. I was with Coach Mack for 4 years, and then with Ben for 4 years. They were quite different. You know, Ben was a New Englander. He was from Boston. He was a Yankee. Coach Mack was very much a country boy from the South. But they both, I mean, they both expected you to perform. I remember, you know, they give you a job. They give you a job to do, and you go and do it. And you do it right, and you make it good. And they were that way. And I remember one time I got this big salary increase at the paper. And I asked Ben why. I mean, I thanked him, and he said, you produce. I remember him saying that, you produce. And I appreciate that because I worked awfully hard. But, you know, Ben was the... He was very much involved with running the paper, but he wasn't for me. He wasn't a guy who came in with a pencil and worked the copy. You know, I don't think I ever had him actually edit one of my stories. Other editors did that, but he was always there. He read the paper, and he would let you know when he liked it. You know, when he mm-hmm. liked something you did.
Well, he was one of the towering figures of journalism of all time. Editor of the Washington Post from 1965 to 1991, and of course on the front lines of the Pentagon Papers and Watergate, and left an indelible mark on journalism. He and Woodward and Bernstein, he bet his career on their integrity and their ability, and it worked out rather well, and he certainly didn't shy away from the fame and adulation he got. He enjoyed it. I think he enjoyed it a bit more than you enjoy yours, John Ed.
Well, yeah. Thank you, Jim. I mean, thanks for the nice things you say about me. I'm always a little bit embarrassed by any praise. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe it's because I'm an old offensive lineman. But, you know, Ben, I never spoke to him about Watergate. We never had that discussion. I made a point of not bringing it up. I guess I thought he got that all the time. He asked me what it was like to play in Tiger Stadium. I remember that. He was, he wasn't a guy who talked a lot about sports. I think he loved writing. He wanted the paper to be a writer's paper. So most of his hires were people who could really tell a story. And I was often surprised by the stories of mine that he responded to. You know, sometimes I thought I'd write a really nice piece and wouldn't hear a word, and then I'd write something that I thought wasn't so great, and I'd hear from him. But he liked voice, you know. He liked language. He liked storytelling, and but he was a giant. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, he was a giant, and he did have this presence. When you were around him, it was exciting. I worked with so many great writers and editors and artists, and they were all just in awe of Ben.
Now, you came along about the same time as the biggest setback of his career, the Janet Cook
right.
scandal. He offered to resign. Of course, they did not accept his offer, but that had to take some starch out of him.
It did. You know, that was very much in play when I was hired. I remember I sent them a resume, and I included everything on the doggone thing. I had every little award I'd ever won, and they checked out everything. They called people. They really vetted that little document. And, yeah, it was a bad deal. I saw her one time. I was in a bookstore around in the DuPont Circle area, and she was in there. And she was a striking woman, quite beautiful woman. And, you know, I just didn't. I sort of wanted to talk to her, but I didn't. But yeah, that was a low point. But you know, there are so many people who went through the post, so many fine writers, and I just can't look on that as being really his responsibility. I mean, that was a moral failure. That was her failure, and it's too bad that he was there when it happened.
He had an eye for talent. He not only saw your potential, but many others, many people who are at the highest levels of journalism today, other than Woodward and Bernstein, they owe their careers in good part to Ben Bradley.
Yeah, he would hire great people, and he would throw them into that newsroom, and if you know, it was survival of the fittest, and you had to be good or you were gone. And there were, God almighty, there were so many fine writers. I'll name a few for you. When I was on the sports section, we had like Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon. People know them today as these talking heads for ESPN. They've got their show. But they were both really talented writers. A guy that joined the staff when I joined, David Remnick, is today the executive editor or editor-in-chief, I'm not sure about the title, of the New Yorker magazine. But, you know, it was that kind of deal. Tremendous talent. Christine Brennan, Sally Jenkins, Gary Pomerantz, Paul Attner, Dave Kindred. Tom Boswell was writing baseball back then. It was an amazing staff and well-edited, but you had to prove yourself. I mean, you had to do it. I was single, and it's all I did. I mean, I worked every day, and they would they expected that. I was there. You know, I was on the road a lot, but when I was home, I was working. And I don't know. It was a great time in my life. It was exciting. It was hard, exhausting. At times, it was difficult, you know, really difficult, but thank God I had that experience. It's amazing to me all these years later that I really lived that, you know, that I did that. But it was fantastic to be one of Bradley's writers. What a deal.
Well, John Ed is still doing his thing and doing it rather well. His newest novel has gotten nice plaudits, as it should. Call Me By My Name. And I know you've got a few more offerings in the works.
Let's hope so. Thank you, Jim.
Well, thank you, John Ed Bradley, who, of course, was an associate hired by Ben Bradley, and I'm sure the fact that they had the same last name with one letter different was a source of conversation. And John Ed, we'll talk with you soon, I hope.
Thank you, Jim. Take care.
We shall return with the incomparable Lodrick Monroe Cook in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org, and Frank Barnett is producing. We're pleased to have in studio the incomparable Lodrick Monroe Cook III, an American business titan produced by Louisiana State University, who came from part of the world that most people never travel to. Even those of us from Louisiana rarely go to his formative birthplace, and the exact spot is?
Well, I was born in Castor, but I grew up in Grand Cane.
Grand Cane, Louisiana. And how many were in your high school class?
Five.
Five. And did you graduate at the top of your class?
I wasn't even in the top 20%.
So I guess that means you were number two, right?
Actually, three.
Three.
Two girls were ahead of me.
Okay. Well, it worked out rather well, and you have always made note and have done so in a tangible way that it, in large part, was made possible by going to LSU.
Yeah, but it was a great experience, and I was fortunate to have that opportunity. By the way, I enjoyed listening to your interviewer, John Ed Bradley. You can tell he's a great storyteller.
Yeah, and it's amazing how many people in so many walks of life have been produced by Louisiana State University. And for many years, I don't think the university saluted them as they should, and now that has changed. And there are people in the arts and sports and business, and you are not only a business titan, having been the chair of Atlantic Richfield, but you have been a great philanthropist with LSU and in other endeavors, and as we've noted before in appearances on this show, Lod Cook, a friend of many presidents of the United States from different sides of the aisle, from Ronald Reagan to Bill Clinton, you knew them well. And 1993, Bill Clinton becomes president. His politics are much different than George H.W. Bush, the man he defeated, and your dear friend. And somehow, some way, you and Clinton get together. How did that happen?
Well, he started having luncheons at the White House with business people from across the country. And I got invited to one. And it was a very pleasant experience. It happened to be my birthday, so someone had tipped him off. So he had a birthday cake for me, so that broke the ice very well. And at that moment in time, we were all concerned about the deficit, as we should be and should be still. And I was invited to say a few remarks along with him and Vice President Gore, and then ended up really speaking to a group of people about the subject. So he pressed me into service right away, even though I was a Republican, because we shared some of the same thoughts about trying to deal with the deficit.
When the Lod Cook Center opened in 1994, Presidents Carter, Ford, and Bush, they were all there, and Nixon had just died.
Yeah, I'd had dinner with him at his home up in New Jersey, the two of us. A very pleasant evening. He proudly showed me around what Pat had done, his wife, in decorating the house. And I invited him to the opening of the Alumni Center, and he quickly said he would come. And then, unfortunately, he passed away before it happened.
And Reagan had just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
And he had visited LSU a couple of times as my guest and had spoken about the alumni building. He knew about it and hated not to be able to attend, but he was, because of his illness, not able to come.
Were you responsible for him speaking at a graduation ceremony, the one in Tiger Stadium?
Well, I invited him and brought him down for that.
So. Yeah, he stayed at the old faculty club then. There was
They redid it, put in new carpet and and everything for him, and it was about time they did. It was nice. They enjoyed the trip. Nancy came with him, and we had a great, great trip. We made a lot of trips together. We went to London and Oxford one time, and other things like that.
Well, you were head of Atlantic Richfield, where you'd worked for many years.
39 years.
So how does a kid from Grand Cane, Louisiana, become head of one of the great business entities in the world?
He goes to LSU and takes petroleum engineering and gets lucky.
And gets lucky. And you were chair for how long?
I was chairman for 9 years.
9 years. Mm. And during that time, if I remember correctly, LSU played a game in the Coliseum against the University of Southern California. And Jim Wharton and Charlie Roberts, they came knocking at your door.
Yes, they did. And Charlie became my most expensive friend ever because he talked me into helping to build the alumni center and then later the hotel. He did a terrific job during his years as president of the Alumni Association. Mm-hmm. We're very proud of those facilities, and I think they're a real addition to the campus.
Yeah, well, Charlie has had his challenges of late, but those buildings would not be there without him, I don't think.
That's correct.
Now, we won't stay on this too long, but I'm sure you're grieved by the problems he's had. He's a good friend of yours.
Yes, he is a very good friend, and I've enjoyed the relationship through the years. And so is Chancellor Wharton. I made many great friends at LSU.
Well, LSU is a university which has alumni all over the world, probably more graduates in the city of Houston, for example, than many of the Texas schools. And a lot of it has to do with what you're talking about, the oil and gas industry, of which LSU has produced a number of luminaries, including the most prominent one, the man I'm looking at right now, Lod Cook. But you ended up in Los Angeles, California. That's where Atlantic Richfield was situated, right?
Well, eventually it was situated there. Atlantic started out as Atlantic Refining Company in Philadelphia, and the Richfield Corporation in Los Angeles. After their merger, then they merged with Sinclair, and the three companies became one, Atlantic Richfield Company. Mm-hmm. We were in New York City as our headquarters just prior to moving to California.
You adjusted well to the West Coast, though.
I love it, yes.
And that's where you met your wife, Carol.
Carol. I went to my dentist, and they had hired Carol, and I suddenly had a lot of problems with my teeth and had to keep going. So we dated and married in 35 wonderful years. Unfortunately, I lost her 5 years ago to cancer.
I think I was told by somebody else that you actually at that time lived on a condo above the dentist's office, and you would kind of look down and see if
I lived yes, I was single at the time, obviously, and lived in a condo and looked across the street. I could see into the dentist's office. I knew when she came to work. I knew when she left. So she didn't have a chance. In terms of me, I wasn't stalking her, but I really was interested.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Was it a hard pursuit? Did you have to work to win her heart?
Well, we went together about 9 months, and in most cases, relationships have to go forward or be ended. And we kind of came to that point. Fortunately, I asked her to marry me, and she said yes, and we had a wonderful, wonderful life together.
I think you can tell the story here about the rooster and the hen.
Oh, well, as a chairman and CEO of ARCA, of course, occasionally I would have to make speeches in various places. And one of my favorite stories was about Carol's new hobby. I obviously was traveling a lot in those days, and I came home from one of my trips, and she met me at the door, was very excited. And I said, "What's going on?" She says, "I have a new hobby." "What's that?" I said. She said, "I'm raising chickens." Well, I thought that was kind of funny because she'd grown up in Beverly Hills. I said, "Okay, show me what you're doing." So she took me out in the backyard and proudly pointed out two roosters and one hen. And I started laughing. I said, "Carol, everybody knows you don't need two roosters with one hen." She says, "Yes, you do if one of them travels a lot." Anyway, she started going with me on all my trips after that.
Somehow, some way, you get involved with Augusta National. You're an avid golfer, but
I'm below average golfer.
But how did that happen?
You don't really know. You get invited, and you're happy to say yes.
Yeah, and you were head of the club, right?
No, not that. But I was invited, and I joined. I've been a member for, I guess, over 20 years now.
Board of directors?
No.
No? Okay. But that's the most prestigious place in the world to play golf, and Lod Cook is a man who knows the links. And
it's also a great place to eat fried chicken.
Is it really?
Oh, they have some of the best in the world.
Well, it makes sense considering what part of the world it is in. But so many highlights in your life, independent of the business success you've had. But a listener notes that you were involved with the restoration and resurrection of the Roosevelt Hotel, which is one of the crown jewels of the industry in New Orleans, just off Canal Street. How's that going?
Doing great. I'm a minority partner in the hotel. There are five of us, and it's been very successful. We were fortunate enough to be able to qualify to, as a historical property, and we did renovate it from top to bottom. We kept looking for the deduct box, but we never could find it. I don't know how many of you know that story, but apparently during Governor Huey Long's period of time he was in office, there was a deduct box at the hotel.
Never found. Mm-hmm. And he took the band leader at the Roosevelt at the Blue Room, Castro Carrazzo, took him off the floor, kidnapped him, brought him to Baton Rouge, and made him the band leader at LSU.
And we have LSU has a terrific band, and they have a Bandorama coming up in November that I hope everybody can go to. It's a marvelous evening of music.
Well, Lod is here, and he'll see the Ole Miss game Saturday night.
Absolutely.
Should be an upset, a very good one. But he was born in 1928, which means he was born the year Huey Long was elected governor, and a year after the great Louisiana flood of 1927. Those were tough times, right, in the heart of the Depression.
Yeah, they were. We had to scramble. Fortunately, we lived with access to a farm, so we were able to raise most of our food. But my mother and I used to sell vegetables door to door to make ends meet.
It worked out. How many siblings did you have?
I had a brother and two sisters, both still live, all three still living.
So there's some good genes in the Cook family.
And my mother lived to be 96, and her mother lived to be 96, and her father lived to be 96. So I'm counting on that side of the family.
You've got at least another decade to go.
Right.
And you're not resting on your laurels. Perhaps the biggest project Lod Cook's been involved with, and he was involved at the highest levels of Atlantic Richfield and Global Crossing, is something that is in the works right now, NeuroSigma. This could be groundbreaking as far as treating people with depression. What's going on with this burgeoning company?
Well, we're in the process of doing a roadshow. We've held back temporarily until the market settles down a little bit and the biotechnical stocks. But NeuroSigma is a wonderful opportunity to work on the problems of epilepsy, depression, ADHD, and PTSD, and perhaps some other things. That we tap in to the nerve in your face called the trigeminal nerve. And we're able, through use of stimulating that nerve, to affect certain parts of the brain. And then that, in turn, affects the bodily functions related to those parts of the brain. Our trials initially have shown improvement in those four areas, particularly in epilepsy and depression. We're further along in our examination of what this does. But through the use of CAT scans and MRIs, we know what's happening. We're not zapping the brain with electricity. We're stimulating it with a pulse generator at a certain frequency that causes these things to happen. It's a miracle, really, when you think about how the brain is designed and how it impacts the rest of the body. We're fairly far along in some aspects of this. We're able to treat people in Europe now with approval and also for epilepsy, and also in Canada for epilepsy. We have some time yet in the U.S. to get our FDA approval. We have some more clinical trials to accomplish, but it's exciting.
It potentially could be a game changer, and you've got all these great scientists from University of California, Los Angeles, who moved across the street and joined you on Wilshire Boulevard. How did you do that?
Well, my partner and I formed a company a few years ago with the idea of looking at what's, in many cases, locked up in university labs and seeing what we might be able to bring out in a commercial way to help people. And we stumbled on, actually, luckily, a scientist at UCLA, Dr. Chris DiGiorgio, who had worked on this technique of stimulating the nerve that I spoke about. And he and other scientists there have joined our group, and we were making the progress that I mentioned. We also just announced with the Veterans Administration a study on treating brain injuries with this approach, and hopefully that'll work out too.
Where have the trials taken place?
In various parts of the country. The clinical trials for the epilepsy, which will involve 300 patients, will be all over the country at different universities. We've done some trials at USC right there in Los Angeles, as well as UCLA. So it depends on who's interested and who wants to work with us, and then we move forward.
And this will be a publicly traded company.
That's our hope, yes.
Now, you've been down this road before with Global Crossing, which you started, and at one point its value on the market was worth more than General Motors, wasn't it?
That's correct. Actually, my partner, Gary Winnick, was the leader there. I was his vice chairman. We had huge success initially, and then we got bogged down in technological improvements and everybody else jumping into the market with their own version.
But what you started, even though it didn't work for Global Crossing, it's worked for others. The concept worked, didn't it?
Oh, yes. Actually, the cheaper prices that people pay today for their phone calls around the world was a result of our jumping into that business and breaking the costs associated with the previous way they're doing business.
Now, as mentioned, you're born in the Depression, lived through World War II and all that's happened since then, and all the changes that have happened in the United States and around the world, and the continued evolution and the turbulence that we're having. Where do you see the world going right now in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, it's a little bit discouraging. All you read about is chaos and problems, but I tend to be an optimistic person. I think it's important for the U.S. to stay strong and remain tied to its values and to deal with these issues as we move forward.
We will spend a few more minutes with Lodrick Monroe Cook III and also hear from Dr. Monty Sullivan, the new head of the Louisiana Community and Technical College System. Back after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest for a few more minutes is Lod Cook, former chair of Atlantic Richfield, and he headed Global Crossing, and now he's involved with NeuroSigma, and he continues to be involved with his alma mater, Louisiana State University. As we've talked before, you also have a degree from Southern Methodist University, but not nearly as connected to SMU as you are to LSU.
Well, I went to SMU at night and got a master's degree, and it was a great experience. But obviously the thing that brought me into the world, really, from a small country town was LSU.
LSU, and made all the difference. What year did you graduate?
I graduated in 1950, and then after the Army came back and got another degree in 53.
And
I'm sorry, in 55. I came back in 53.
Went to work 39 years for one company. And how has the oil and gas industry changed in the last 40 or 50 years?
Well, it was a great experience for me. I wasn't very much of an engineer. Fortunately, I got into other things. But that was a great entry point for me. And the industry's changed quite a bit. All of a sudden now, we look at more barrels from the U.S. than we did back there then, and that's exciting.
Mm-hmm. Now, you live in an area where people are traveling in cars by the millions, literally. We depend a lot on oil and gas. Do you ever see that changing in the century to come?
Well, I think there will be more use of alternative fuels as we move forward, but it's awful hard to change a system, but it depends on oil and gas overnight. And you consider how much dependency there is for that energy. Unfortunately, in California, we have a lot of untapped reserves, but trying to hit a balance between that and environmental concerns has been difficult.
Mm-hmm. Your governor is up for re-election in California. You're a Republican. He's a Democrat. What do you think of Jerry Brown?
Well, I think he's done a pretty good job. We had problems in the state in terms of our budgets and other things. And, of course, Jerry's had a lot of experience. He's been governor several times. And of course, his father was governor, too, for a period of time. I think he'll be reelected, mm-hmm. and he's done a good job.
How closely do you follow what's going on in Louisiana?
Pardon?
How closely do you follow what's happening here with the governor?
Well, I read about it and keep up as much as I had the pleasure of visiting with Governor Jindal when he was out at the Reagan Library a few months ago. So, and I keep up with what's happening through the Reveille and occasionally get a chance to read The Advocate.
You read the Reveille. I'm impressed. And Lod Cook, of course, stays in the hotel, which bears his name, and he'll be there this week, as will the LSU football team for Ole Miss. What do you think about the game against the Johnny Rebs?
I think we're primed for an upset. I believe the team has moved. It obviously has improved the last several games. I had an opportunity last weekend. That, as you mentioned, the team does stay at the hotel on Friday nights and have their meetings the next morning at the alumni building. I had an opportunity to meet some of the players. They're quite impressive young men.
Well, thank you, Lod Cook. It's always a pleasure, and we're glad you stopped here on some of your trips to Baton Rouge, and thanks for your contributions to our alma mater.
Thank you, Jim. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. And we're joined now by Monty Sullivan, the man who heads the Louisiana Community and Technical College System. Good morning, Dr. Sullivan.
Good morning, Jim. How you doing?
Doing well, and you are a man who has served in six different colleges, two state community and technical college systems over the last two decades. How's the new gig working?
You know, it's going great. It's great to be in Louisiana and in a role at a time that is so very important to the people of Louisiana and to the business community for sure.
Dr. Sullivan, you have some experience at the Delgado Community College, one of the important entities in education in Louisiana. That's one that I think most people in the state know about, but probably are not aware of the contributions that Delgado has made to the greater New Orleans area and to the state as a whole.
You know, Delgado is one of those institutions that is so very much connected to the fabric of New Orleans, an institution that's been in place for over 90 years. Many people don't quite know the historical impact that Delgado has had. One of the institutions and locations that was so very important to the building of the Higgins boats that were so critical in winning World War II. I can remember clearly a picture that hung in the office area while I was at Delgado that was a picture of the manufacturing of the Higgins boats, and nearly every one of the 200 or so people in that picture were female. It's really an extraordinary picture and sign of the time. So to the perspective that Mr. Lod Cook brought to your show a few minutes ago, I think it's important to think about the great generations of this nation and the workforce and the impact that we've mm-hmm. been able to have across the globe.
Well, it was the historian Stephen Ambrose who said that none other than Dwight David Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander, said the reason our side, his side, won the war is that the Higgins boats, that without them it would not have happened.
Well, and those boats built the warehouse, in fact, for many of the much of the work that went on there is today the location of the modern day baseball field at Delgado Community College. So lots of history there, and if you look back at the history of that institution and really several of the two-year colleges across the state, really built around the notion of advanced manufacturing. But in that day, it was really about the building of ships, barges, and at the time, so very important to international affairs.
We're visiting with Dr. Monty Sullivans. He's the system president for the Louisiana Community and Technical College System, and he was appointed on February 27th, so we're talking about 8 months ago, and he's involved in something called Workforce 2020. Tell us about this plan.
You know, as came into this office, I guess, about 8 months ago, and when you have conversations out there in the public with nearly anyone these days, from as a candidate who may be pursuing public office to the folks in the coffee shops, anywhere you go, the discussion is about workforce. The discussion is about an economy that is doing extraordinarily well, but our ability to sustain that economy over time is really directly related back to our ability to produce a workforce that is skilled and can address the needs that are out there today. And so as an organization, we took on a whole series of conversations with about 200, 250 people from across the state, thought leaders, business leaders, agency heads from state government, higher education leaders, and we just asked a very simple question. That question was, what does Louisiana need from its two-year colleges? And not an agenda of what our colleges need, but instead, what do the people of Louisiana need from us? And the amazing thing about that process, from a couple of hundred people, you got a very common set of dialogue back from those folks. And it was consistent in terms of the references to workforce. It was consistent in terms of the need for credentials that are recognized as credentials that are important to industry. It was also really interesting that one of the elements that came back to us was a quality metric that we haven't typically thought of in higher education, that industry said back to us is, if we're willing to pay for it, then there's quality there. And there's a sea change in mindset that goes along with that. So a quick reference to the six goals. We came out of this plan with a public agenda that is about what Louisiana's community and technical colleges will do for Louisiana in the next 6 years. By 2020, doubling the number of graduates from 20,000 students to 40,000. Also doubling the annual earnings of a graduating class. This past year's graduating class is on pace to earn about $725 million in Louisiana's economy. By 2020, that number should easily be $1.5 billion. Again, that is not an economic multiplier. That is a very specific set of actual earnings per graduate as you walk through. The third goal, quadruple the number of transfer students moving from two-year colleges to four-year colleges to about 10,000 per year. It is so very important that our two-year colleges are that on-ramp to the bachelor's degree for so many people around the state of Louisiana. In order to accomplish those three student success goals, we know that we must double the number of students served in our institutions. While we typically think of institutions as being measured by fall enrollment, our two-year colleges last year had 111,000 students in credit programs, unique students. 111,000 students in a fall, spring, and summer term. In addition to that, another 35,000 workforce training students, another 33,000 adult basic education students, so touching over 165,000 people mm-hmm. in a given year's time. It is a substantial footprint. But if we are to accomplish the goals that I've outlined to this point, we must double that number to about 325,000 students served annually. To give you an idea, that's about one in seven adults in Louisiana. That would need to be served by community and technical colleges annually.
What about Baton Rouge Community College? How is it doing?
Baton Rouge Community College is doing very well. It's an institution that is clearly on the grow. It's on the grow from an enrollment perspective, from a workforce perspective, granting clearly every single year having one of its largest graduating classes over and over again. It's an institution that is one of the shining stars, I think, and I think what you're also seeing is a bit of a resurgence in the workforce development area with a recent hire of Charlie Freeberg, who is just doing extraordinary work there to really connect the college more strongly to the business community and be responsive. So back to the Louisiana 2020, a great example, connecting with that business community.
All right. Rinaldi and Sherwood, you're on with Dr. Monty Sullivan. Hi, Rinaldi.
Welcome, Dr. Sullivan. And listen, I really enjoy listening to this. I was reviewing, Jim, the average wages of, for example, a laborer in construction in Louisiana right now, and it's $13 an hour. And I'm just wondering, how can we, you know, the old game was, okay, you either went to trade school or you went to college. So what's the new dichotomy in the workforce for guys like me that are ready to hire people?
And I didn't hear the first part of your question there. I do apologize, but I believe your question is what is the kind of the new perspective of how you find a labor. I think what you're going to begin to see happen, and it's happening particularly for the larger employers, is they're looking for people who have a skill set that is a documented skill set. I think there was a point in time, and particularly I remember during my own college days, going out and seeking a labor position, and when someone asked you about your experience, you told them what your experience was. We're quickly reaching a point in time with certifications from national organizations like the National Council for Construction Education and Research, where an individual documents that skill set, and so as a prospective employer, you know what you're buying on the front end in terms of skills. So I think that's a direction that you're beginning to see this entire sector move in.
All right. Well, Dr. Sullivan, we wish you well, and certainly we look forward to talking with you again. And congratulations on ascending to your new post as president of the system, and you do important work for our state. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We're joined now by Carrie Lynn. She will be at the Louisiana Book Festival a week from Saturday, and she is a journalist with extensive background in nonfiction, but she has written her first novel, and it's called Madam. Good morning, Carrie Lynn.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know you're up early in Los Angeles, and Madam is it's an adult novel. And about New Orleans, of course. Tell us about this story and what captivated you into writing about something that was a big part of the Crescent City not so long ago.
Well, Madam is based on the true story of Storyville, which was New Orleans' 20-year experiment starting in 1898 with legalized prostitution. And it was a huge success, the experiment, but a lot of records had been destroyed, and a lot of the names and the faces and the places had been lost. So I had stumbled upon the story when I was visiting New Orleans about 10 years ago, and it was the story of one of the madams who rose to incredible wealth and infamy. Her name was Josie Arlington, and it was a story of her haunted tomb, and it wasn't so much the hauntings that appealed to me, but the story of her rise from very, very poor, meager beginnings to being one of the most notorious, wealthy, influential madams.
Well, with a lot of famous people are intertwined in your book, and of course, I think the most famous person to have been born in that area was Louis Armstrong, Satchmo himself, and he's in your book.
He is. Louis was a little boy when Storyville began, and he would shovel coal in the bordellos. And he grew up hearing these sounds because the sounds of jazz were born in the bordellos. So Jelly Roll Morton, before he became Jelly Roll Morton, is also a character in the book, and he would play in Josie Arlington's bordello as well as those of her rivals. And that's where the sound began, and you know where Louis heard it. The other cool thing about Storyville is that it birthed these all-night dance halls, and Joe King Oliver got his start there. It was just a really fertile ground for live music, for crowds who would come out, you know, into the wee hours of the night, so after work hours. So these were, you know, so musicians who worked all day could come and play in these dance halls, and there weren't very many noise restrictions because the entire area, there were bordellos. So it was a very welcoming crowd, and it really it created this renaissance in New Orleans. So not just music, also fashion. Storyville became a tourist destination for politicians, actors, you know, every who's who really around the world at the time visited Storyville.
It's all detailed in Madam, a novel of New Orleans from Carrie Lynn, who is an accomplished journalist who, and up until now, specialized in nonfiction. What prompted the change?
I had wanted to write a nonfiction book about Josie Arlington. That was my initial goal. But the city had destroyed a lot of records, and after Storyville was closed, and what the city hadn't destroyed, hurricanes had. So there wasn't enough to fill a whole book, but I couldn't let go of the story of her, and so it came out in this form, which is...
We got a roll, Carrie Lynn, but we'll see you at the book festival. Congratulations on Madam, Carrie Lynn. Until tomorrow, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.